When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Key London councils swing left, ending decades of Conservative dominance. Sadiq Khan calls for rent freezes as the Bank of England hints at looming recession. New levelling up and planning reforms outlined in the state opening of Parliament. And a little-known Islington Council architect wins the prestigious MJ Long Prize. My name is Merlin Fulcher, I'm an architectural journalist, and I'll be bringing you a roundup of this week's top London architecture news. Welcome to The London. My guest this week here at Bureau in Design District is Leanne Hartley. Leanne is Director of Social Sustainability Consultancy, MEND, and founder of the collaborative women-led network, Urbanistas, which is celebrating its 10-year anniversary. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Last week, the country took to the polls to vote in the local elections, which saw the Conservatives take heavy losses, especially in the capital. The party of government lost a staggering 480 local council seats throughout England, Wales, and Scotland. And in London, the number of elected Conservatives hit a damning record low, with historic dominance of Wandsworth, Westminster and Barnet town halls all evaporating. The results and the reasons behind the Conservatives' disastrous performance have been dissected by the national media and the Twitterati. The AJ has run an in-depth analysis of how, in the case of Westminster City Council, the contentious Marble Arch mound may have sealed the Conservatives' fate. In London, just 401 Conservatives won council seats, leaving the party most in control of outer suburban boroughs, especially those who voted Leave in the Brexit referendum, such as Bexley, Bromley and Hillingdon. Furthermore, seven councils in the capital now have no Conservative councillors at all, forming a significant threat to the party's decision-making power across vast swathes of the inner city. As predicted, national issues such as the cost of living crisis, Partygate, and contentious plans to ship asylum seekers to Rwanda were all top of the agenda when it came to voting. However, more local issues, including low traffic neighbourhoods, that's LTNs, and pledges to deliver more council housing, also swayed results. Tower Hamlets' mayoral race was won by the outspoken and famously anti-LTN Lufta Rahman. The independent candidate previously held the same office until he was removed for electoral fraud in 2015 and has made a comeback following attacks on LTNs for allegedly increasing congestion and CO2 emissions. Elsewhere, there were some small wins for the Conservatives, including in Croydon, where the party's Jason Perry was named mayor, an outcome that came as little surprise to many observers following the Labour-led council's ongoing financial issues, which have seen its house-building arm brick by brick wound up. That's something we've discussed here on Lundown many times before. On last week's election special with Jenna Goldberg and Sean Adams, we zoomed in on three boroughs which looked up for grabs: Lambeth, Barnet and Westminster, all previously held by Conservative councils. All three were won by Labour, an outcome which, although predicted, still sent shockwaves across the capital and took the front page of Friday's Evening Standard. In Westminster, the re-elected Labour councillor and new cabinet member, Jack Barraclough, said MVRDV's ill-fated and much-mocked £6 million Marble Arch mound was a key factor in the Conservatives losing power over the borough. Speaking to the AJ, he said, quote, "The Conservatives shredded their reputation as being careful with taxpayers' money with the mountain." And he went on to add, "We put Marble Arch Mound on all our leaflets." So, Leanne, to some commentators, it has seemed little surprise the Conservatives struggled to win votes, especially with the ongoing cost of living crisis and the recent Partygate scandal. But I think a lot of people, the Conservatives included, were pretty surprised at the scale of the losses. In London, issues including low traffic neighbourhoods, housing and the infamous Marble Arch Mound may have significantly impacted the vote. What do you make of the fact that so many built environment issues were so influential in the ballot box when typically they can be thought to be quite marginal?
Well, I think the answer is it'll be different for different boroughs. Ultimately, I think people care really deeply about where they live and their access to services. National issues are influential, but from a local perspective, there are examples of built environment issues that either way influenced the local vote last week. For example, new housing development on Greenfield land and LTNs arguably enhanced the Conservative support in Enfield, a borough in which I live. And the financial mismanagement of urban schemes proved to be toxic for at least two established councils, the Labour in Croydon, largely a result of their failed intervention in the property market, and in Westminster, where, as you say, the flagship mound proved so controversial. Ultimately, though, there's a view that a change in administration is healthy for democracy and avoids the stagnation of approach and philosophy. And clearly the people of Westminster, Wandsworth, Barnet, as well as Croydon and Harrow, were keen for a new approach. And they were willing to change long-standing voting habits to initiate this. Yet, while local elections tend to focus on hyper-local issues, there was, I would say, definitely the sense that frustrations with politics at the national level did feature into people's decision-making, i.e. the lack of trust, the layering of scandal on scandal has really revealed a government that's out of control and also out of touch. In Wandsworth and Barnet, maybe, the national frustration won out. But I agree that the built environment has presented an influential factor, and I can't help think that underpinning this is a focus on public health and well-being and concerns over climate change that's been brought into sharp focus with COVID-19, that's still ongoing, let's remember, and our recovery from that. The built environment, I mean, it was our sanctuary, wasn't it, with lockdown after lockdown. And it really opened our eyes to how important it is to have access to clean, safe and tranquil environments for our physical and our mental well-being, and indeed how difficult it's been for people that don't have access to that. So tackling air quality, tackling pollution, tackling safety on our roads highlight the built environment as a public health issue. And whilst the specifics around issues like LTNs and active travel massively reflect local issues and politics, at the heart of these initiatives are concerns with really macro structural wicked problems about how we are to address the climate emergency and the impacts on our future way of life. So these go beyond short-term political cycles, and it'll be fascinating to see how this plays out and what demonstrable change a change of guard will bring. With an hour being a long time in politics these days, I have a feeling that it's been really hard to have medium term horizon on anything at the moment. But here we have councils changing hands over people's concerns over the long term and who they trust to handle that.
That's absolutely fascinating. And I really like the fact that you zoomed in on the cost of living crisis being a major issue, especially affecting Londoners. It was certainly prominent in the campaigns of all the parties. And sadly, it's about to get a whole lot worse for everyone. What kind of things do you think councils and government can be doing to mitigate some of the impacts on their constituencies? And what sort of challenges will all London local authorities, but especially those that have recently changed colour, face over the next 4 years as they attempt to deliver and improve services in such a challenging context for our cities?
Well, look, councils are in a difficult position. I mean, the over 10 years of financial austerity were really very hard, with significant cutbacks on revenue support from central government and an underlying philosophy that they need to be financially self-sufficient as organisations. They've been working their built environments to the nth degree, trying to amalgamate services and improve service delivery. How much can we expect councils to do? Where is the revenue coming from? The ability to have a macro influence is limited without cash. Yes, you can work the estate even harder, but some councils will be better and able to do this than others. I mean, Westminster has lots of money coming in, but it also has significant pockets of deprivation. They've been doing this for years, not just as a recent response. There's been a long-term squeeze on councils, and now we're putting more pressure on councils to tackle and address, again, the failings of central government. What might be seen as a quick fix by central government, for example, making commercial property more affordable, or by granting rates holidays to alleviate pressure on occupiers, has the indirect impact of cutting revenue, which in turn impacts on service delivery. I mean, by and large, I think London boroughs have been very entrepreneurial and innovative in using the civic estate to enhance economic and social value outcomes. Surplus land, for example, has been released for housing initiatives and been partnering with other public sector bodies, health being a key example, under the One Public Estate programme, so that they can be more efficient in local community service delivery. Avoiding duplication of services, better joined up working between the health sector and third sectors, being more collaborative to make best use of scarce resources are things that could be done. But they're easier said than done. They're already doing the best they can. Central government needs to be learning from and trusting local government more. They are the ones on the front line. They are the ones on the sharp end. They know better what works and what doesn't work. Fund them and free them to do this. The more central government frees up councils to be more in charge of their finances and strategic decision making, the better for local areas in the long term.
The Bank of England has warned of 10% inflation and a near recession as early as the end of this year, as it raises interest rates yet again. London's mayor has meanwhile promised to take the cost of living crisis head on with a call for rent controls over private tenancies. While the UK was in the polling booths last week, the Bank of England raised the interest rate from 0.75 to 1% in a bid to cool the economy and curtail the spiralling inflation, which has recently been made even worse by COVID lockdowns in China and the war in Ukraine. By raising interest rates and therefore making it more expensive for businesses and private individuals to borrow money, the bank is hoping it can reduce the current immense pressure on a limited pool of goods and services and labour, which is resulting in rocketing prices, something all of us have felt recently. This story was reported by The Telegraph, by CNBC and The Guardian, which has also published a comprehensive breakdown of the interest rate rise and a handy forecast of the possible financial consequences to come. The hike in interest rates brings with it the highest cost of borrowing since the 2008 financial crash, and warnings that the price of energy bills could jump by another 40% in October. That's on top of the 54% increase last month. All this spells perilous times ahead for Britons and, of course, for Londoners. And experts warn it is those on the middle and lowest incomes who'll suffer the most. So what can be done to mitigate the scale of the crisis? Well, London Mayor Sadiq Khan has stepped forward with one possible answer. It's something he has actually tried before. Earlier this year, Khan called on the government to grant him the powers to introduce private rent controls in the capital. It was a plea he also made to ministers back in 2019, but to no success. His proposal to freeze the rent paid by tenants to private landlords for 2 years would save the average household around £3,000, providing a lifeline for struggling people during an unprecedented time of escalating costs. That's according to data supplied by City Hall. Khan said, quote, "Private renters make up nearly a third of everyone living in the capital, and they're set to be hit by a devastating combination of price and bill rises. Too often, the needs of private renters are ignored by both landlords and the government. A rent freeze would," he argued, "give people a chance to get back on their feet after the pandemic." So, Leanne, private renting has exploded in London. Since the 1990s, the proportion of Londoners renting privately has more than doubled. And the average private rent for a one-bed property in the capital is more than that of a three-bed home in every other region of the UK. Can you explain what are private rent controls and what sort of an impact would they have in London? And also, why are they so controversial when they're standard in many other comparable cities, including Berlin and parts of New York?
Well, private rent controls are about achieving a balance between landlords getting a fair return on their property investment with protecting tenants from unreasonable rent increases. I mean, beyond the social housing sector, there are no rent controls in the UK. This was swept away in the 1987 Landlord and Tenancy Reform Act, which created the assured shorthold tenancy and effectively removed security of tenure for private renters. Now, the 1987 reform was in response to years of very restrictive and controlled residential tenancy legislation. For example, granting security of tenure and tenancies for life, which made it a significant risk for property owners to let property for residential purposes. I mean, it effectively killed the private housing supply. So what the 1987 Act did was to effectively move from one end of the spectrum to the other. And this created an absolute boom in the private rental sector. Now, the market has moved on significantly in the last 35 years since that legislation has come in. And the London property market and developers have become very reliant on build-to-let as a means of shifting their stock. I think the controversy and resistance to change is mainly around the number of smaller investors who retain maximum flexibility over their asset. There is a worry that blanket radical reform could strip the private investor supply out of the market. And unfortunately, this could accelerate the housing crisis. Now, there's some logic in this risk, and the solution really is to introduce gradual reform so that we can align with this middle ground that Germany and America have in their approach, rather than sort of the uber-controlled 1970s model. Now, Sadiq Khan's ideas on capping rents could go some way towards containing those costs from tenants, and that's not to be sniffed at. But it will not appeal to landlords. With the prospect of rising rates and therefore their costs, it could mean more landlords leaving the market. And that could mean tenants losing access to vital local housing and property options anyway. So I think it's definitely right for reform. The market's definitely moved on since 1987, but we don't need short-term remedies to tip us back to the other end of the spectrum again. It's about building long-term sustainable solutions.
Fantastic. Now, what's interesting, the Bank of England says it's treading a narrow path to steer the UK through this financially turbulent time. However, the bank is still predicting gross domestic product to shrink in the last quarter of this year. If economic output shrinks for two consecutive quarters, then we're technically in a recession. So, Leanne, what could be the implications of a fresh downturn for Londoners? We lived through it in post-2008. It was pretty bad, especially when costs of living and housing already so high, probably even higher now than they were back then. And also, what sort of longer term measures beyond private rent controls could make London's economy more resilient for what is looking like an increasingly unpredictable future?
Wow. I mean, so much to unpack there. I mean, I do think a rent cap is a high risk short term fix, in that the cost of borrowing, as I said, mortgage repayments for landlords increasing as a result of interest payment rises. I think it will force private landlords to sell. Will that lead to a glut of properties flooding the market and reducing affordability for buyers even more? I mean, possibly not if the freeze is only for 2 years. But as I said, major central government reform is required. And this needs to allow tenants and landlords the flexibility and the ability to enter into longer term tenancies. For example, with a balance to meet the needs of landlords and tenants, which suits both of them, or it just won't work. I mean, I think we could also incentivize institutions, for example, to provide rental supply. And they're not at the mercy of the vagaries of individual circumstances. Institutions have more checks and balances to underpin their investment. But I think, you know, the private rental sector is here to stay. It serves a purpose and it works in other parts of the world. But we do need to adapt to a modern context and circumstances. And we do need to address the cultural aspects too. So, yes, I think, you know, for me, it's about landlords being able to be incentivized to offer that longer term lease and enable that cultural shift away from restricting these short term leases.
This week, Prince Charles delivered the Queen's speech at the state opening of Parliament, emphasising the importance of getting the UK economy back on track to tackle the rising cost of living. This is a story which has appeared across the national media and was covered in a special live BBC News television programme and prompted a flurry of comments from experts across the built environment. The Queen's speech, which forms part of the ceremonial state opening of Parliament, allows the government to lay out its legislative plan for the year ahead. This year, it was delivered by Prince Charles, the Prince of Wales, who later stepped in after the Queen was unable to attend due to mobility concerns. The speech outlined 38 new laws, ranging from pledges to support the Ukrainian people to new laws smoothing the Brexit bill transition, and of course, long-awaited legislation to enact the levelling up agenda, something which had won support for Boris Johnson's Conservative Party in the general election 3 years ago. The speech, which inevitably was designed to entice back disenfranchised Conservative voters and MPs, followed their disastrous local election results. It also proposed a bill containing tougher penalties for protest groups, including Insulate Britain and Extinction Rebellion. That's something we've discussed a lot before on this show. The levelling up agenda featured heavily as the government set out watered down plans to reform planning regulations, including the introduction of a locally set non-negotiable levy, which will be placed on developers and will help councils deliver essential infrastructure, including schools and roads. Over the weekend, Michael Gove, who is Secretary of State for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities, trailed some of the speech's contents in an interview with the Daily Telegraph, in which he said the failure to boost home ownership was a key reason for the Conservatives' failure at the polls. He also outlined the influence of Poundbury on his levelling up vision. Poundbury, spearheaded by Prince Charles and designed by Luxembourg architect Leon Creer, is an experimental town in Dorset, featuring almost entirely traditional architecture. The Telegraph remarked that, quote, Poundbury's importance to Mr. Gove is due to the fact that he sees the town as an embodiment of Biden, the key elements he wants to incorporate in Britain's new homes. That is beauty, infrastructure, democracy, environment, and neighbourhood, spells out the word Biden, B-I-D-E-N. Other bills pledge to strengthen landlord rights in the UK, which will give them new and stronger grounds for eviction surrounding rent arrears, which is when rent is not paid, and also shorter notice periods for antisocial behaviour, all of which place private renters in an ever more precarious position. Other bits of the legislative agenda include giving councils the right to sell off empty properties on local high streets and the potential for street votes, allowing people to vote on design codes governing development locally. There was, however, very little in the opening of Parliament which addressed the cost of living crisis directly, with subsequent press releases simply pointing to what the government has already done. That was something that the Labour leader Keir Starmer picked up on. He said, quote, times are tough for working people, but they are much tougher than they should be. Some 12 years of the Conservatives has meant low economic growth, high inflation and high taxes, he said. So, Leanne, what do you make of the legislative agenda set out in the Queen's speech?
So, in the Queen's speech, we have some headline-grabbing initiatives for the built environment. But as ever, the devil is in the detail and the fine print of how these policies will operate. For example, levelling up delivery is being passed to councils. Now, will they get the additional resources required to enable delivery? It is worth noting that levelling up support to date has overwhelmingly been capital, not revenue. And why would a private landlord keep a shop empty? The challenge in recent years is not the level of rent, but actually a combination of a lack of demand. I mean, think back to the demise of the high street store, BHS, and the as yet unreformed level of business rates. We therefore await with interest the details of the non-domestic rating bill. However, of course, this leads to a reduction in revenue for councils. This is the circular argument, that it could impact on service delivery for some councils reliant on property income to support their service delivery. But however, the investment in the right type of infrastructure is really welcome. But I think this needs to go beyond the macro headline grabbing likes of High Speed 2 towards the more micro level infrastructure that we need around things like schools, community centres, local roads and our traffic calming measures to advance the active travel and carbon reduction objectives we have.
So it's interesting because the speech, it outlines yet more planning reforms, albeit watered down from what was originally the plan a year ago. Now, the planning system in the UK has been overhauled time and time again, especially since David Cameron was Prime Minister. I can't remember a time when planning reform wasn't on the agenda. Last year, Robert Jenrick proposed a highly criticised planning white paper. It was later dropped. Why have successive governments focused on planning reform, especially as a means of solving the housing crisis? And why has such an approach so far failed to yield really any significant results?
Ah, the planning system. It seems to be an unwritten rule. You get a new prime minister, you get a new government, and obviously the first thing they want to do is unpick, play around and tinker with the planning system. Now, so the housing crisis and the challenges on increasing supply can be traced largely to a series of conflicting policies, which are, you know, noble in isolation, I think, but often work and conflict with each other. Planning system reform often seeks to find a short-term fix to a particular issue, but unfortunately this can create another. For example, increasing affordable housing targets can make some development inviable for developers, and this in turn reduces the overall velocity of that supply. So why can't the government adopt a ground zero approach and create a brand new planning system from scratch? Well, one of the challenges is the sheer billions of pounds that's tied up in the existing system. And even a slight change could have a major impact on the value. And local and central government have a vested interest in that value through the local taxation system of protecting the value in their built estate. So I think if anything would help, it would be better to make planning more process driven rather than political. The delivery of housing needs to be left to planning teams to ensure that the schemes are in accordance with local plans that have been developed with local consultation and the finer grain of design and the supporting infrastructure it requires. Now, lots of councils have taken a long time to build their capacity and supply chain to deliver social housing. It's not a tap you can switch on and off. It takes a long time to do this. Croydon have tried this. Bexley are starting to do this. Canada are making great strides. And people think building social housing is easy. It's not. It's very complicated. Government needs to recognise this. And following the right to buy policies of the 1980s, here we are again talking about the being the sharp end of this sort of history. An entire generation of public house builders was lost. And we're now effectively starting to try and replace that. And again, pepper potting of private ownership in council estates. We now need to buy those leaseholders back. So a historic policy is now hindering that supply.
One of the proposals put forward, obviously, it relates to these new rules around design codes, which will allow local residents to have their say on developments in their area, the so-called like street votes policy. Now, pointing to this model, Gove said, quote, you don't get that sort of resistance if you've got a community like Poundbury. I don't know, I've actually been to Poundbury and met people who did complain about the next homes because the next homes block the view from their home. So I don't know quite how many people he's talked to in Poundbury, but the quote goes on, you get a resistance, effectively resistance against new development in area to it from when a few modernist architects who sneer at what the rest of us actually like. So effectively blaming grassroots opposition to new homes on modernist architects and their influence on the outcomes, visual outcomes of the buildings. Leanne, what do you make of policies like these and also that kind of rhetoric that the housing secretary is using? I mean, I have to ask this. Could it just be a distraction from the real issues? I mean, we're hearing right now there's 4 million children living in poverty in the UK. 55,000 children and families were evicted from their homes in the last 3 months of 2021. Is this all just a kind of epic distraction from perhaps a more hard-hitting, direct way of levelling up?
Yes, frankly. I mean, is this really about design and aesthetic appearance? Surely it's about the wider benefit of good design on things like reducing and mitigating flood risk, providing healthy environments that promote and support our well-being and inclusion, and also the impact of a scheme on existing infrastructure such as schools, housing and health. So yes, I think arguably it is a distraction, you know, a built environment culture war, if you like. The lack of capacity and choice can enable an environment for poor design decisions to prosper. So for me, engaging people is absolutely key. But you don't ask them at 5 minutes to midnight to rubber stamp what you've already decided they're getting. Communities are all too often bystanders in the development process, despite being profoundly affected by the changes that process can bring. The planning process can be a mystery shrouded in tiny fonts on signs on lampposts, aggressive institutional speak, over-the-top bureaucracy. Instead of being receivers of development, local people should be agents of change, helping to define and steer the shape their own neighbourhoods take. So I think we need to be gearing up communities to be savvy clients and representative permission givers themselves. And I think we need to do this quickly.
Fiona Monkman, an architect at Islington Council for nearly 25 years, has won this year's MJ Long Prize for Excellence in Practice, part of the Architects Journal and Architectural Review's W Awards. This is a story that was announced by both the AJ and AR this week. You'll be forgiven if you haven't heard of Monkman before. She is a design team leader within the London Borough's Architecture Department and a, quote, huge advocate for social housing. Unfortunately, up until now, social housing hasn't always been on the front page of all the glossy architecture magazines, but that is changing. Monkman was awarded this prize. This is a prize that's open to UK-based female architects, and it's judged on an overall body of work with an emphasis on projects completed within the previous 18 months. Monkman was awarded it for her collective work as part of Islington Architects' team working on several social housing projects. These include Centurion Close, which adds 8 two-bedroom council flats to an existing housing estate close to Caledonian Road. That was on a site that had been deemed unviable for developers. The judges were deeply impressed by her work, saying, quote, Centurion Close is able to infiltrate the nooks and crannies of Caledonian Road. This work could and should be replicated elsewhere. That's the role, the very important role that these wards play today. And Monkman shows that tenacity is the way to do it and the way to get things done. That's the judges' citation. Ruth Lang, a previous guest of the Lundown, wrote in the Architectural Review in March, quote, Monkman is a huge advocate for the power these schemes hold to beneficially affect lives on a daily basis through the spaces provided, the aspirations they set, the improved quality of life, and the increased life chances that such care to where we live can bring. It's the effect on the daily lives of Islington's residents which has the most value for the architecture created. The award, which is named after the acclaimed British Library architect, lecturer and writer Mary Jane MJ Long, was judged by AKTT2 co-founder Hanif Kara, critic and regular Lundown guest Catherine Slesser, and MJ Long's daughter Sal Wilson. The panel was chaired by AJ technical editor Fran Williams, also a recent Lundown guest. Last year, Peter Barbara Architects Associate Director Alice Brownfield won the prize in its second year of running. Brownfield was handed the award for her incredible work on Kiln Place in Camden, a local authority-backed infill project on a London council estate. Leanne, can you paint a picture of Fiona Monkman's work for our listeners? And what do you think about her winning this prestigious prize?
Yeah, I'll try and do my best to do justice to Fiona's career, which has been an absolutely fascinating tour de force of social housing. So Fiona studied architecture in Sheffield and actually did some work experience in the council in the late 80s, which, of course, was the height of Thatcherism, where council housing was sold off left, right and centre and wholesale, and no council housing was being built. So she was working in a backdrop where people were living in very tough circumstances and there was widespread poverty. And this contrasted with Britain's post-war mass house building programme, which really freed people from poor living conditions. And I think this really coloured her outlook and influenced her work with the importance of power of housing to impact people's lives, both positively and negatively. So over the past decades, she's reflected that Tory governments have tried to roll back the public sector. And that made her very committed and even more committed to social housing. In terms of her architectural style, she describes this as responsive modernist, and working in Islington, this has meant responding to Islington's traditions and vernacular with a modernist interpretation. She really sits in that junction between modernist and Islington's traditional 18th, 19th century street patterns, which are often very constrained. Now, she's worked in Islington for 25 years, and so she knows these streets intimately. She understands the rhythms of everyday life and the individual people that live there. She's empathetic and she listens to the people that live there and what they want from their homes, seeing homes as not just units that we discussed earlier. For me, Fiona's success in winning this prize really speaks of civic pride and dedication at the heart of her work to looking at the wider social benefits that good housing brings and elevating the importance and value of council housing, that it should be as beautiful and high quality as any other type of housing. And she's achieved this through her leadership and tenacity in delivering this beauty and quality and care in sites and project environments that have been deemed unviable. So that's credit to her skill and vision and fighting for her projects.
I mean, look, some people turn off when people start talking about architecture awards. I mean, there are a lot of architecture awards, but this one, the MJ Long Prize, is part of the W Awards. Like, that's a suite of awards which also includes the Jane Drew Prize, which last year went to Kate McIntosh, someone that Open City has been championing a lot, someone that gave a speech at Dalston in Earth last month, with a major event with hundreds of people that we put on with London Society and others. Why are awards like this so important in architecture, but also beyond in London's built environment culture?
Well, I think this harks back to why I founded Urbanistas, which I know we're coming on to shortly. But 10 years ago, I was 18 months into a new business. I'd started with no funding, no experience, no clients. Startups were different then. I'd taken the plunge because I felt I needed to connect my own civic values with my work as a regeneration practitioner. My business is Mend, is all about mending that connection with people and places. But in the course of creating my business, and in the 10 years leading up to that, I'd encountered so many amazing women who I connected with, and I came away being very inspired and energized by. But I didn't see them, I didn't hear them, and I didn't read about them. And why was that? And I kept encountering these women, and I started to feel frustrated by this lack of visibility. We really need to see women and normalize them as leaders, as innovators, and as change makers. We need to acknowledge the lens that they look through, the questions they ask, the experience they have of cities and spaces. We need to hear women and their ideas for making cities better for everyone. That is why these awards are so important. It shines a light on them, and it shows other women and society as a whole the value they bring, and inspires more to do the same. So more of this, please.
I mean, obviously, you're saying, Leanne, you're one of the founders, or you're the founder, sorry, you're the founder of Urbanistas Collective, celebrating its 10-year anniversary this year. What have been those big achievements over the past 10 years? And obviously, why is the work of the collective more important now than ever?
So yeah, we're 10 years old next week, and we have a celebration on the 18th of May at ING offices. They're kindly hosting us, so please come and join us. I think, in all honesty, the biggest achievement is that we're still here. You know, we are powered purely by enthusiasm and volunteering. We have absolutely no funding. I think that really is at the core of what makes Urbanistas really special. It's entirely open. We are entirely independent, and we're completely free. So, and that model has been exported to now cities around the world. We have a very simple structure. We're about providing that platform for women to come together, to share their ideas for making cities better for everyone, and engaging that peer-to-peer support amongst women to make that idea happen. We encourage our members to bring an idea to what we call our expo meets. These are an opportunity for women to hear other women's ideas and hear their ask. And the ask is really important, because I think we're normalized to think that asking for help is a sign of weakness. Well, actually, asking for help is really empowering. It empowers the person asking, because it forces them to sort of think clearly about what they need. It empowers the person providing support for that ask to be able to pledge their help and utilise their skills and experience. So I think it's more than ever, it's important to enable that peer-to-peer support to help women to help other women, and encourage women to be a little bit courageous and explore their potential, grow those leadership skills. And at 10 years, I think it's fair to say we've had maybe 5 or 6 cohorts of leadership at our chapters. So myself and my partner, Rachel Fisher, who has helped me to grow this over the 10 years, we're really proud of our chapter leads. And we've got them, as I say, we've got them in the Northwest, the Northeast, we've got them down in Cardiff, we've got chapters in Brisbane, we've got chapters in Sydney, Rotterdam. We're never failed to be inspired by just the amount of energy that is brought by our chapters to Urbanistas, and making it so special.
It's absolutely fantastic. And hopefully we'll be able to profile some of those researchers and leaders on the show as the year goes on, as part of that 10-year anniversary celebration. We're going to move now to our culture section. Big exhibition opening this week is Space at the India Club. It runs until the 15th of May. The India Club is at the Hotel Strand Continental on the Strand. I don't know if anyone's ever been to it, but I've been there once or twice before. It is an extraordinary place. It's like a kind of a little bubble of history with a really cool bar on the first floor overlooking the newly pedestrianised Aldwych with that church with the magnolia trees outside King's College and Somerset House. And they serve really good drinks and food. But obviously, it's the exhibition that's there. It's called Space, and it's put together by Specular Assembly. It's a collective group with a number of artists who've put work into it. One of the artists is Will Jennings, who's going to be on Lundown in the future. He's a very prolific Twitter commentator. People might be familiar with him. So Will's put in a work called Dissension, a mixed media installation channeled through an imagined protagonist living in London's Vauxhall and recording the changing built environment around their home as they slowly get priced out of the capital. The description goes on. He says, the red lights on cranes and newly built towers take on a new meaning of place, and in them hopes and fears for the future. The work comprises photogenic installations, video text and lights. Leanne, you going to check it out?
Of course I am. Be an absolute fool to miss that. And it really, I'm really interested in how we create cities in our heads. So the city that lives in our kind of internal narrative and internal memory, and that really speaks to me. So I really am looking forward to seeing that.
So the next big culture item is kind of a global one, but it's also, I think, very specific to London. So it's the Eurovision final on Saturday with Essex TikTok star Sam Ryder, who's the UK entry. Now, I don't know, it's kind of hard to believe. Well, it's weird and it's uncanny, but it's true. The odds have put Sam Ryder's UK entry as the second most likely to win after Ukraine. But there's a good link because... the story's about space, space being a very architectural thing, space being the exhibition, the name that Will Jennings' work is in. Do you know the song, Leanne?
I'm an enormous Eurovision fan. This is one of the highlights of my year, so I cannot wait. But good luck to Sam. I will be watching.
Okay, and then also that brings us on to another little bit of culture going on down Deptford Way. It's an exhibition of buildings photographed, modernist buildings in Britain photographed by Chris Matthews at the Gareth Gardner Gallery on Resolution Way. This actually also runs till the 15th of May. And basically what it is Matthews did a kind of photographic tour of Britain's most celebrated modernist buildings. It was part of a commission to capture 300 of these buildings for the new Owen Hatherley book, The Guide to the Modernist Buildings of Britain, something we've also profiled on the show. An extraordinary book. It's like the book to buy this year if you're going to get one book, architecture book. It's a lovely book, and it's for a big architecture book, it's amazing. You know, it really is a great one. So Matthews travelled all over Britain, took pictures of all kinds of different buildings, a selection of them feature in this gallery space, the Gareth Gardner Gallery. I just looked at my list. There's another tiny culture note. Okay, this qualifies as culture because we're a built environment show. The Northern Line Bank branch is opening on the 16th of May.
Yay! I worked on that project.
You worked on it.
I'm quite proud that it's. I worked on that and Crossrail, which is also opening this month. So I'll be looking forward to whizzing through the tunnels that I worked on. So it brings it a lot more alive for me personally. But I think,
it's going to be great. Well, thank you, Leanne. Thanks for making those projects happen. A cultural highlight for us all. Okay, well, it's been a great pleasure to feature you on the show. Where can our listeners keep up to speed on the projects you're working on, the things you're writing? Is there a website or socials they should look to?
So my Twitter handle is Leanne Menz City, and we're actually launching our new Urbanistas website at our birthday. So I encourage everybody to check out urbanistas.org.uk. And my own platform is leannehartley.co.uk.
You've been listening to The Lundown, a show from Open City, rounding up the big stories in architecture and the built environment each week in London. If you've enjoyed the show and want to know more about any of the stories we've discussed, we recommend subscribing to the Architects Journal, which has covered all these issues and many more too. You can find the show on Twitter or Instagram at Open City London, or by using the hashtag Lundown, LNDDWN. Open City receives no public funding, so if you want to support our work, please go to open-city.org.uk/support and sign up as an Open City friend. Open City is dedicated to making London a more open, accessible, and equitable city.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.